What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
On January 31st of 2023, Lindsay Clancy woke up in a hospital bed at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She had just been taken off a breathing tube and she was paralyzed from the jump that was supposed to kill her. A chaplain named Sheila Kavanaugh sat beside her and held her hand in this moment of chaos. I don't know any other way to express it. Clancy's first words: "I'm so glad that my children are safe." 7 days earlier, she had strangled all three of them. Kavanaugh did not correct her. She answered the way a chaplain answers, telling Lindsay her children were safe and in heaven with God. Then the two of them prayed. On the 17th day of the Clancy murder trial, that hospital room went in front of the jury, and the testimony took about 20 minutes. Those 20 minutes handed the jury the question this whole case turns on. What do 12 people have to believe about this woman to decide the voice in her head was never real? Because that's what the prosecution certainly wants. They want you to believe that is a fabrication. Okay, well, let's play a little game of how do we get there. Kavanaugh testified that Clancy talked about a voice, a male voice, persistent, with a command: kill the children and then herself. If she didn't obey, the voice told her neither she nor the children would be safe. Kavanaugh said Clancy returned to it across multiple visits. Then prosecutor Jennifer Sprague stood up and landed the end of the day. Kavanaugh kept notes on her visits. The notes covered her interactions, her thoughts, her feelings, and Sprague asked whether the notes ever once recorded Clancy saying she heard a voice or what that voice said. And Kavanaugh answered, correct, never once, not in the notes. That's a real point. And it deserves straight treatment. A witness described years of conversations about a voice, and in her own paperwork never mentions it. Sprague's job is to find gaps like that, and she found this one with a single question. This is the job of an attorney, of a prosecutor, of a defense attorney. Whatever role you're playing, you're looking for gaps. The gap matters because of who the burden is, or who carries the burden in this courtroom. Nobody disputes what happened inside the house on January 24th of 2023, except people on the internet who seem to know better. The defense agrees Lindsay Clancy is the one behind this. She strangled Cora, Dawson, and Callan with exercise bands. The only question left in this trial is the condition of her mind while she did it. That's really what is on trial here. Massachusetts law puts that question on the prosecution. This is important. Clancy raised a lack of criminal responsibility defense, which is the legal name for an insanity defense. And once she raised it, she stopped having to prove anything. She's not the one who has to prove she was in a psychotic state. It's now the state, the Commonwealth, has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was criminally lucid, having an ordinary Tuesday. Everything was good and fine. And if you've been watching the trial, pretty much every piece of evidence has shown her brain was nowhere near a condition of just another Tuesday, and she's just completely with it. That means proving she had no mental disease at all, or proving that, even sick, she still understood the wrongfulness of what she was doing and could have stopped herself. That's what they have to prove on the state's part. Prove a woman wasn't psychotic beyond a reasonable doubt. The voice sits at the center of that fight. So the state has to convince 12 jurors, or 18 actually in this case, the voice was never real. There are only two roads to get to that conclusion. Road one, the chaplain can't be trusted. And let's take a look at who that road runs through. Kavanaugh visited Clancy about 14 times at the hospital, then kept coming back on her own, roughly 200 visits at Tewksbury Hospital across 3 years. Nobody pays her to testify. She isn't a hired expert building a report for either side. And by her own account, she wasn't there to evaluate anyone. She also acknowledged that parts of what a patient tells a chaplain stay confidential. So this whole gotcha thing is kind of like going to a priest and saying, well, what did they tell you in confession? Those things can't make it into a courtroom. They don't have to make it in a courtroom. Which means her notebook that prosecution's pointing at going, why didn't you write this down? Was never built to be a medical chart. She may be the one witness in this trial with no stake in the outcome. And she may be just the most neutral party in all of this. And one of the roads you kind of got to go down if you're going to say that the voices aren't real, one possibility, and hear me out, there's going to be two, so just before, but what about, there's going to be two, would be having to say the chaplain is lying. Basically, you're saying the priest is lying. I know she's a chaplain, just saying priest for the sake of it. Well, she may not be lying. Lindsay may have told her that. Yes, you're right. That is road number two, where Lindsay was trying to convince the chaplain she was hearing voices. Lindsay Clancy lied to her. That would be the other road you'd have to go down to believe that she was not in a state of psychosis and this is all one big ruse. So following that, let's follow what that requires. It requires a woman who woke up paralyzed, learned her children were dead by her own hands, and within days began planning a false story with a chaplain. Then it requires her to carry that lie through 3 years and 200 visits with a person whose notes she had no reason to think would ever reach a courtroom. It also requires her to beat a professional. Defense psychologist Paul Zeisel spent more than 35 hours with Clancy. And part of the forensic evaluation is testing for malingering, which means faking symptoms for a benefit. He testified he found none. No malingering. No faking. Prosecutors went after Zeisel hard. Errors in his report and the dual role of treating Clancy while working for her defense. But attacking the evaluator is not the same as producing evidence she faked. Above all, it requires her to be a kind of person the prosecution's own case never produced. The state called roughly 70 witnesses across 3 weeks. Those witnesses described a labor and delivery nurse who loved her job and loved her children. Prosecutors allege her motive was that she wanted to die and didn't trust anyone else to raise her kids. And even that theory describes attachment. Nowhere in that testimony did anyone describe a manipulator or a liar. Neither did the man who lost the most. The man who half of the country thinks somehow did this, despite there being absolutely no evidence in that direction whatsoever. Just a lot of icky feelings and a lot of projection and a lot of people that find Patrick Clancy triggering. And I don't know why. I had this conversation last night with my wife. I'm like, why? What is going on here? Why is Patrick Clancy, the man that kind of looks like Seth Meyers? As I was trying to figure out, who does he look like? I've heard a lot of people say he looks like Koberger. I'm like, he looks like Seth Meyers a lot more than Koberger. I don't know. He doesn't feel, there's a lot of figures that we cover that seem to be triggering for whatever reason. Patrick Clancy is the one that a lot of people are projecting their own shit onto. I don't. Is it the trip? Is it the fact that he went on to Costa Rica and went hiking by himself and then stayed in hostels across Europe? Because he didn't want to be in an environment where he'd have to see families and he would have to have people be asking him questions constantly at home and being bombarded by every person every time he moved himself out of his home where this horrific incident happened. People everywhere coming up to him. I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh. All of it. Is it the trip? I don't know. Not trying to make this about Patrick here, but I'm trying to understand where this goes off the rails so badly. I know he left a review on a hiking site about it being a great trip, a good hike, basically. Let me just pause here for a second on that. Because everybody goes, if that happened to me, I hope you wouldn't be on a trip to Costa Rica hiking and leaving a review on a hiking site. Fair enough. And when I look at that, I go, kind of weird that you're taking a trip 20 some days after this all happened. But then I took a moment and I said, let me try and put myself in his shoes. Let me try and put myself in the world of where this is happening. Number one, I don't know that I'd still be alive. I'm going to be completely honest with you right there. I think it'd have to be someone restraining me. If I had lost my three children and my wife is still alive and she did it, and I'm trying to wrestle with what that is. But my three people, I don't know that I'd make it to 20 days, to be 1,000% honest with you. So to go, well, here's what I would do in that situation. If I had a straight up answer, I'd be lying to you. I can't contemplate what the hell that would be like. I don't think you could either, honestly. Maybe you could. I don't know. I'm one who my brain is always going down the 50 tendrils of what if. This is one where my brain just goes, overload. We don't know how this would compute. And I hope to never have to ever be in that sort of a situation. But looking at it from his perspective, what will be coming at somebody? This horrible thing happened. You're trying to figure out life. What do you do? Do you even go forward? Or do you sit in the corner and just stop eating? Or eat yourself to death, or drink yourself to death, or take a handful of pills, or find that revolver that's sitting in the cabinet. I mean, there's a lot of things that could go through one's mind if you're Patrick Clancy after this. What does a trip to Costa Rica by himself and then staying in hostels tell me? That sounds like a I need to go find myself sort of journey. After an event like that, yeah, I get it. It doesn't read that weird when you hear all that. Or do you stay home where you walk out to the grocery store or to a restaurant or to anything whatsoever outside of the confines of the home where this horrible thing just happened, where you shared life with your wife? And I'm sure looking around is going to completely make you just want to die. You need to get the hell out of Dodge if you're going to stay alive. Everyone naysaying at you, be damned. I'd be getting the fuck out of the country too. Not because of anything wrong, because I need to heal my brain if I'm going to continue participating in this exchange of oxygen that we all do with each other on this mortal coil called Earth. I don't blame him. He didn't exactly rush off to go to sandals with his mistress. There was no mistress. There was no other woman. He went off by himself, went on a hike, told other people he sweated a lot on the hike, but it was worth it. It was beautiful. Maybe he got something out of it. Maybe he found some peace. Maybe there was a moment on that hike where he felt the presence of his children. I don't know. But everyone wants to condemn the man for leaving a couple nice words on a website about a hike he took. And then somehow, oh, you're in Costa Rica. That must mean, what does it mean? What does it mean? Sue in Ohio, what does it mean? You tell me. You tell me what you did after your three children were taken off this planet by your spouse and how you dealt. What does it mean? Very few people can ever be in that position to answer that question of what they would do. And I'll tell you what, it ain't none of us. Anyway, I'll get off that rant. Days after the killings, Patrick Clancy released a statement asking the public to find it within themselves to forgive Lindsay, as he had. Is Patrick Clancy injuring people because he's such a kind of a rare character, someone who can actually find forgiveness and not live in the shadow of darkness and the shadow of rage and the shadow of retribution that so many of us live in, where we got to get back at somebody. We got to find this. The fact that he is the one above all who should be searching for the demon in this case and wanting it destroyed. The fact that he isn't doing that, is that what is causing all of this rage? He's not doing it, so society needs to step in, and we're mad that he didn't do it to go after the evildoer in this, so he's evil too because he forgave. Is that the connect the dot pattern here that we're looking at? I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out because it does not align with fact. He wrote that the real Lindsay was generously loving towards everyone. Him, the kids, her patients. The person with the most reason to call her a monster refused to. The state has one more version of Road 2, and this one points at the psychologist and said, prosecutors suggested Zeisel coached Clancy to invent the hallucinations. Well, he denied it under oath. The suggestion has a calendar problem. Zeisel first reached Clancy's bedside on February 4th of 23 under a court order her defense team obtained. The chaplain heard, I'm so glad that my children are safe, on January 31st. The sentence existed before the man accused of coaching it actually ever met her. The prosecution does have one piece of this argument that's stronger than the rest, and it should be said plainly. Before January 24th, the voice appears nowhere. Her medical records from the weeks before the killings contain no report of voices, and Zeisel acknowledged that on the stand. The silence wasn't for lack of chances. Clancy checked herself into the McLean Hospital, a psychiatric hospital, on New Year's Day of 23 and stayed until January 5th. After discharge, her outpatient psychiatrist, Jennifer Tufts, saw her by video four times, and the last appointment came on January 23rd, the day before the killings. Asked at trial whether Clancy ever said she was planning to kill the children, Tufts answered no. By Zeisel's account, she described a voice on February 6th and a call to Patrick from her hospital bed. The call went out on Zeisel's phone on speaker with him listening. A defense psychiatrist offered one explanation for that silence, and it's pretty easy to understand. We see it in our chat. We see a lot of mothers talking about this. Mothers conceal psychotic symptoms out of fear their children will be taken away. Well, they should be honest. Well, yeah, there's a lot of shouldas. And that's a very real fear. Because if you're feeling you can control this, where is this coming from? This is not who I am. This urge, that's not me. I can control this over here. And me controlling it is a better option than the system taking my children away and giving them to strangers. That's the math equation that's running through a lot of mothers' heads. And the jury can weigh that. But standing alone, a symptom that first appears once, a murder charge is waiting, looks convenient. And the state knows it, and they're trying to make a big point about it, even if it is fact. The timing argument has a problem, and the prosecution built it themselves. They pulled Clancy's phone and put her search history in front of the jury to prove planning. That same extraction shows that she was typing help in the weeks before January 24th. In late December 22, she searched about insomnia and bipolar disorder. In January, postpartum depression. And less than a week before the killings, a forensic examiner testified she searched symptoms of postpartum psychosis. The searches sit inside a wider paper trail. Police seized her journals from the house, and the final entries came within a week of the killings. The defense read one line to the jury: "I'm drowning every day." Another entry described her mind trying to make something physically wrong with her out of desperation for a break from caring from everyone. She put it in writing for a prescriber, too. She told psychiatric nurse practitioner Rebecca Giolotta that she didn't know how she felt on Remeron, an antidepressant. And she wrote that she started having very intrusive thoughts that I never had before. What does that mean? What are those thoughts? Well, that's unfortunately where the question stopped. Giolotta testified she never saw psychosis or mania in their sessions, which means the thoughts arrived in writing while a woman in front of her still looked composed. And for whatever reason, tell me about those thoughts. Wasn't something noted. That doesn't mean they weren't there. The record was built before any charge existed and before any defense needed building. It was a woman with a phone and a notebook tracking her own mind as it slid, recognizing this is not me. None of it can be backdated. A person who invents a psychotic voice after the fact has no reason to research psychosis before the fact. The state's timing theory says the symptom arrived on schedule right when the defense needed it. The state's own exhibits show her circling it while her children were still alive. So no, the prosecution will still have its case for control at closings. Witness described Clancy playing in the snow with her kids that afternoon and taking her daughter to a doctor's appointment. Prosecutors paired her phone's check of Patrick's drive time with medical testimony about how long strangulation takes and argued the math is planning. The jury will have to hold that math in one hand and the paper trail in the other. Closing arguments are expected very soon. 12 of the 18 seated jurors will deliberate. The law hands them the Commonwealth's whole burden, proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Lindsay Clancy was responsible for what she did. Whatever they decide, the verdict has to pass right through that hospital room. Her first words when the tube came out, "I'm so glad my children are safe." If the voice was real, that sentence is the sound of it still working. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. We'll continue our conversation right there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
There's a lot of trials going on right now. When it rains, it pours, right? This year has been rather slow on trials, but now we have three big ones happening at the same time. The Lindsay Clancy trial, getting close to wrapping up. We're going to talk about that first and some of the revelations that have been made in the last 48 hours in just a moment. Also, the Jared Bridegan murder trial. That's really three trials in one, or three separate trials, truly, for the one person. Right now, Mario Fernandez Saldana on trial. That's the
the husband of Jared's ex-wife that she married, who's accused of being involved in his demise, and also 30 years in the making, the trial for the murder of Tupac Shakur. We're going to go into the latest on all of that today. Your thoughts in the comments section, drop them there, and we're going to do our best to try and answer your questions as we work through a lot of Q&As today on the program. All right, let's get into this. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, notes. My co-host, with me as always. And
look at these notes, all these cases. Look what I got to do to try to keep these names straight.
It's a little homework, you know, but once you get them ingrained in your mind, then you just wake up in the middle of the night in hot sweats going, oh my God.
Well, yeah. You know, we've been so absorbed in the Lindsey Clancy case that my entire brain has been just nothing but this. And then we got these other cases, like you said, that have popped up and we've covered one of them pretty extensively. Yeah. So I literally had to go back in and repopulate my brain with all these other, hopefully it all keeps organized as it comes out. If I refer to my notes throughout, I apologize. Hey,
it's
I have
okay.
wire diagrams.
I think it's fair to say the amount of cases we cover, if one of us catches the other confusing a fact from another, go ahead and say it out loud. I did it the other day. I was talking about one of the cases, and I mixed up the attorneys that worked out of the mortuary or out of the crematorium, which is, in fact, that's Donna Adelson's attorneys.
Right.
And I mixed them with someone else's. I forgot whose. But I'm like, they work out of a crematorium. And I was completely wrong. But,
and I don't know how you do it. I'm only with you an hour a day, but you create content on all these other cases all day, and I have no idea how you keep.
I
it
do
straight.
My best. It's a lot of trying to keep notes straight, and AI certainly helps me with that. But I think I broke mine. I go off the rails all the time, so I'm relying on my memory, which is not always the greatest. But anyway, let's jump into this. We're going to go over a lot of the questions here, a lot of the stuff you guys have been dropping in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, please do check out our YouTube channel and hit subscribe. And then drop your comments in there. These are some of them. Some of these things we've talked about with other experts amongst ourselves, but they're still being asked. And I thought, well, let's do our best to try and dive into it. The prosecution just rested in the Lindsey Clancy trial. 14 days of testimony. The jury heard her husband's 911 call. They walked through the house on Summer Street on a field trip, basically, with the jury. They watched her sob while doctors described trying to save her three children. And now the defense has started calling witnesses. Her mother, people who knew her, and they're all saying the same thing. She was a loving mom who was drowning and couldn't get anyone to hear her. You've seen it in her own writings, in her own diaries. It's all consistent. This is a woman who was begging for help, wanting to feel like herself. The question that's ripping this audience apart hasn't changed since January 23. If she was that sick, how did she plan it that carefully? That's what a lot of people are asking. And let's try and get into it. I think there's flaws in the question itself. and it seems a lot of them seem to hover around the psychosis and the understanding of psychosis. And if you're just joining us, if you haven't seen the piece that we did with Siobhan earlier in the week or last week about the difference between someone who is psychotic and someone who's in a state of psychosis, go watch it. That will explain a lot more to you about what it is, because it's a fundamental understanding of what the two actually are. They are very different things. The question we have, her first psychiatrist, the one who had 14 telehealth sessions with her, the one that was talking about the drop-down menus, Tufts, said she never seemed psychotic. That's a qualifying question that isn't necessarily applicable to the situation at that moment, but when presented a certain way, can imply something. If the person literally treating your mind doesn't see it, how is a jury supposed to believe it was there? Megan on Instagram asked that question. I'll let you go, Robin. Go.
Yeah, it's first we have to have our minds open to understanding what a psychotic break is. And that's where we have to do our research. We have to listen to the mental health experts that are experts in psychosis and psychotic breaks. You know, again, go back and listen to Siobhan's episode, actually a few of them with us.
Yeah.
Extremely insightful, as well as the other experts out there. People are saying that there's a lot of mental health experts online that are commenting that this isn't true. They don't believe it. No, I've only found one that believes that. So it's first understanding what a psychotic break is and actually how it ebbs and flows from being prevalent and not prevalent. So in this case also, when Tufts was seeing her, she wasn't in a psychotic break.
Yeah.
Because she just wasn't, because it wasn't prevalent yet. It was starting to manifest. Again, I am not a clinician. I'm just a layman like everyone else watching, observing the behaviors along this. But the signs were there that were heading in that direction. She had postpartum depression multiple times. And I'm going to keep referring back a few times because a lot of people keep making reference to Andrea Yates, because Andrea Yates, a number of years ago, was found not guilty by reason of insanity for exactly the same thing. Offing her four children instead of three, roughly exactly the same ages, and her diagnosis of psychosis was postpartum psychosis. Everyone was saying it was made years ahead. No, it was made 15 months ahead of her final act of killing her kids. So there's a lot of comparisons here. They did not diagnose it early on in her as well. It was only after her S attempt on her third child that it started coming prevalent. So the same thing's going on here. Just Lindsay's a little behind it. And also, the way psychosis manifests in different patients and different human beings is going to be different. But here's some overlaps that Tufts was missing and everyone was screaming at and missing that Siobhan picked up on. And that was the insomnia and the sleep deprivation, which brought on mania. And when the mania started escalating worse, with then you throw more kerosene on the fire with prescriptions in, out, up, down, 13 different ones. I mean, it's a tremendous soup of someone that was just trying to get help and no one was listening to her, as Siobhan pointed out and everyone pointed. So how does it get missed? How did she not see it? The psychosis wasn't manifest yet. It was on its way. And she missed the red flags. That's what the claim is here. She missed the red flags along the way because she didn't have experience. She didn't have someone to bounce the ideas off of that she's supposed to, or that other experts are saying that, you know, you have, after you meet with a client, you have a confab afterwards and you say, hey, here's what I'm seeing. What are your thoughts? Where should I go next?
I have a lot of problem with that question, and I get irked by it every time I hear it asked. It was just the structure of it, because it assumes something that's not reality. It assumes that it was there to be caught.
Right, was it?
It wasn't even there to be caught yet. If every year, here's an example. We'll do a totally different type of diagnoses here. Every year, I tend to get bronchitis at some point in time. The first time I had it, I didn't know I was going to be getting it, but I tend to get it usually fall or spring, one or the other. But if I go to my doctor and I don't quite have bronchitis yet, I'm not going to get treated for bronchitis. I'm going to get treated for something else. Now, bronchitis, you know, it can come on then later on once it's built up enough and you're in that state. But I'm not necessarily going to be treated for bronchitis 3 months before I develop it, or a month before I develop it. It's not there yet. Once it hits, it hits, and you got to treat it. You can do things ahead of time to maybe circumvent you from getting there, which would have been helpful if they had diagnosed her correctly with bipolar and not generalized anxiety disorder, not given her the exact opposite medications of what one should be getting for her diagnosis. That would have been nice, but it wasn't. But you can't treat something that's not presenting itself yet. Mm-hmm. And because it's not presenting itself a month early or 2 months early or 3 months early, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Just the same way when I actually do get the bronchitis coming on and I got to take what I need to take for it, an inhaler and shit, doesn't mean that they didn't catch that 3 months earlier, so you don't have it. You're making all that up. You're just taking that inhaler for fun, aren't you? You're just putting on a show. You're just coughing uncontrollably because you want attention. That's essentially what people are saying about Lindsay Clancy when they're saying that her falling into a state of psychosis, that it's all just, you know, kerfuffery. It's not even a word, but I mean, it is now. It's all bullshit. because it didn't present and it wasn't diagnosable 2 or 3 months ahead of time.
And the planning,
it's not
too
hard to figure out. I mean, it's not a hard argument to make, and it's not a hard one to understand. It's a matter of accepting it, I guess.
And the planning also is a big part of that question, a big part of what everyone's having a hard time with is that, well, how can she plan this? You know, she must just be this evil person because if she's in psychosis, you know, how come she planned it out?
What did she plan out, though? I mean, I know people are like stuck in that she's planning this shit out. Where are we saying she's planning shit out? Because she looked up how to end her own life. I mean,
that's a couple of Google searches, you know, for timing between him going to the restaurant to get dinner and things like. So, all right. So, and regardless of whether you believe it was planned for 24 hours before or not, again, psychotic breaks ebb and flow out. Yeah. Matter of fact, I was just watching. They had only one testimony this morning as of this recording on the 20th. They had only one witness on the stand this morning. It was her pastor that came to her as just a sign it was actually in her hospital and saw her multiple times. And this is the very first one that said the very first words out of Lindsay's mouth after a couple of days of being incubated and then finally removed the breathing tube from her. And this is a couple days after the event of her killing her kids. The first words out of her mouth were this: "Are my children safe?" And the pastor said, "Yes, they're safe." And she gave a religious reference about how they're safe with God and everything. Mm-hmm. And then Lindsay talked about how the command voice told her the only way for them to be safe is for me to kill them and then to kill myself. So in other words, the point of this is saying that even a couple days after this, the psychosis hadn't ebbed off yet. So she was still in psychosis. And so how do you plan in psychosis? How can that manifest? Well, otherwise, she's having normal conversations. It's layered on top of, it's intertwined like this. And so you can actually function and look like a completely normal human being. But when you add a psychotic break, it's not schizophrenia where all of a sudden you're a new person. No, this is completely integrated into it. And so if the integration of this command voice is what claimed, again, guilty, innocent until proven guilty here, although she claims full responsibility for the horror of her children, which is another thing that we do, is it's okay, people, to hold two truths at the same time. The truth of the horror of that she murdered her children, at the same time you can hold the truth that she was in a psychotic break and the mental health system failed her on this one. You can hold both at the same time. It's okay. And that's what people are having a hard time with. So that shows a level of distinction, of understanding, hopefully, of how these two things can coexist together.
You need to hold both things at the same time to truly understand and grasp them. Otherwise, you're not seeing the full picture of this case. I want to throw this one at you. I know I don't think it's on our list of questions, but I want to throw it in. The attorney, Big Bow Lady, the DA, the ADA, the mortal sin, mother and saying you are aware that murder is a mortal
in your
sin.
Religion.
What on earth was that about? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm glad the judge shut her down and shut her up. But where and why was that brought into this case? I don't know. I'm just like, wow. That's
I think all they're able to do, since everyone's kind of saying exactly the same things on both sides, it's just whether you believe it was like psychotic break or not. And so I think what I've been seeing the prosecutors do is they're trying to discredit people. And so I think what she was trying to do with Lindsay's mom, no, it wasn't a mom, it was a stepmother, mother-in-law.
In-law, yeah.
Was to discredit her by putting her statements in conflict with each other. So how can you still stand behind Lindsay and support Lindsay and saying what a loving mother she is when in your own religion, she committed a mortal sin? So I think she's probably trying to discredit her by conflicting statements on that. So I think that's the only thing she's going for.
Oh my God. It just was like, oh my God.
It hurt her. It hurt everyone again. You know, the prosecution, they keep stumbling on themselves with what they're attempting, because you see them unable to hold two truths at the same time.
Well, for the love of God, literally. Like, you're talking about a religion, and if we're going at its core tenets, you're talking about one that talks about understanding, that talks about forgiveness. Those are the core tenets here, not necessarily murder is the mortal sin and you shall burn forever for it. What are we doing here? I mean, at this point, should we just stone her? I mean, out in the courtyard? I mean, if she's going to be bringing this up, it's like, well, let's get out the rocks and bring her out back at the courthouse.
Can you even fathom the amount of empathy it takes and the relationships that Lindsay was able to form with all these people? For all of them, there's not one person, not, think about this, there's not one person in her entire life that's ever known her, that's ever come out on social media, or has been in the witness stand during this trial, that's ever stood against her. And for those people that say she's faking it, that she's pulling one over on us, I did the research. There's not one case in the history that I could research. Granted, if you can find one, post it. I'll research it because I entertain all. But there's not one case ever that I could find where someone was able to pull the wool over everyone's eyes, ever, to this degree. It just doesn't exist, because it would have had to have been preemptive, relationship building, all the way through. Because again, it's been 3 years, 4 years, going on four since the murders of her children. Yeah. Do you think when people have hindsight for that period of time, as they're going through mourning, as they're asking themselves, what ifs, what are the red flags I miss? What could I have done better? What could I have done differently? That they wouldn't have been able to pick up on a wobble in her of her pulling a ruse over. The only thing every single person has testified to was that she was crying out for help.
It must be a very lovely world to live in when you disagree with a fact or something that makes you uncomfortable, and the quick out is just simply stating that it's witchery. It's something she's just lying about it, and that's just the easy explanation, because you can move on with your day. I don't know. I feel bad for the people that the people in these folks' lives when something goes wrong. Because I don't know that these are the folks that I'd be relying on to be there for me if something goes horribly awry that doesn't necessarily follow a path of just everything's happy and rainbows. Because I don't know. Maybe it's different. Quite often it is when it applies in a personal level for a lot of folks versus watching this out there, you know, in the ether. It's almost entertaining.
And it's okay. I mean, it's probably why we're all so exhausted by this case, because there's been so many things put out there that I then research. And so say, and this is not a condemnation of absolutely anyone, but here's what you do differently. Here's what you can add to the things you're doing already. When you hear something like this, hold it. Like we say, hold it and then investigate it. Try to prove it right. Seriously, just don't accept it at face value. Try to, if it's differing from what you think yourself, try to prove it right. If it's something that you thought of up your own, try to prove it wrong. That's what we're talking. That is what really good, thoughtful, critical thinking does. You just hear something and you try to prove it. So I heard this so many times from so many other experts that it's a fakery. So you know what? I'm going to take it at face value. She's faking us out. Let me try to prove it. Yeah. There's no data that supports it. There's zero data that supports it, both her behaviorally, guaranteed, but also from past cases. Yeah. Just looking compared to past cases. That's why they do have things called case law, so that people can actually look at past cases, because past is always prologue to a lot of things in life. And in cases like this, even in rare cases, because remember, postpartum psychotic breaks and psychosis is 1 in 1,000. Yeah. Postpartum depression, 1 in 10. So people will often assume that it must just been a really bad case of postpartum depression. No, those are a lot more common and they're a lot more manageable, although sometimes not as much, because again, we're seeing the failures time and time again with documentation, lack of consistency between providers, coordination between providers, the medical industry with the medications issues. There's so much gaps in this. And we talked to Siobhan yesterday about this, because people keep, the only other case that got this kind of notoriety was the Andrea Yates case. And they said they learned a lot from it, but have they really? Because exactly the same things are playing out and even worse on this one. And if you actually look at the parallels, there are, I did the comparison. There are more parallels with Lindsay's case and Andrew Yates's case than there are differences. The only difference was the diagnoses. And it's not because they missed it. It's because around the same time period, at the same number of birth of children, is exactly when it started exasperating in Lindsay as it did in Andrea Yates. Andrea Yates just had one more kid, and then it actually went up.
Yeah.
Research point.
I know. Look at you with those facts and truth.
Sorry.
I'll do one more on this. The statement, the question is saying, I had postpartum depression bad enough that I thought about driving off a bridge. I got help. I got better. The thing that terrifies me about this case isn't whether she's guilty. It's that she did ask for help and the system still failed her. If a jury acquits her, does that actually change anything for the next mom? Or does the system just keep running the same way? I think there it's two-pronged. And honestly, I think a lot more of it, because reality comes down to, well, what's going to be legislatively the rules for which a medical operation can operate within. So if this does change anything, and we'd have to get to some sort of legislative level of whatever needs to be changed, that will affect change within the medical system. But I honestly think more importantly is the civil cases, because when you start hitting them in the pocketbook and they start going, oh, this is a large liability for millions and millions of dollars, new protocols go in place, rules go in place, other safeguards go into place that would then hopefully protect the entities from lawsuits like this, because there are new and better standards in place for the practitioners operating under it. So there's different ways to affect the infrastructure of this, legislatively and monetarily. But as of right now, they really all were operating within the confines of what is allowed. But this is a case that certainly challenges it.
Yeah. It's interesting, as you're saying that, Tony, I'm reflecting and going through my own context, because our thoughts, opinions, and what we put out to the world is based on our own experiences, which is our own biases and confirmations and all those things. And so I have such little, even more so from doing a show with you, I have such little confidence that major things will be changed in organizations and institutions. I think they'll, you know, if they're litigated and there's money attached to it, they'll put a Band-Aid here and a Band-Aid here, and hopefully it'll get a little bit better over time. But, and here's why I'm saying the but, here's where I think the major things happen in cases like this. It's that village mentality. So here I am inside the FBI. I did not get good at doing my job because I had better legislation, I had better laws, I had better widgets, tools, and techniques I was using in the investigation itself in my little bubble inside here. My ability to be successful was my ability to rally a village and relationships around me that were loving critics that could lend thoughts, ideas, and opinions, objectives, tools, and their own techniques. And so in this case, what that references to me is this case has brought to light a few things. One, it takes a village. And it takes a village to recognize red flags, not just in a medical profession, but all friends and family, which I actually saw all the red flags. The courage to take a little bit more bolder action, you know, in this case, because if you don't have a context of what could go sideways, you're never going to assume it does. And that, I think that's exactly what was going on here. No one in her family understood, like none of us did until this case, the effects of insomnia, the effects of lack of sleep, the effects of all these things. And so all the red flags were there that we all now know more about. And so people in our lives, even if the medical system hasn't successfully fixed this problem, and also it's going to be jurisdiction dependent, it's going to be resource dependent, different areas around the country. So some place might get really good, some place is going to continue to suck, you know, in the hills of Appalachia, you know, where we have that other horrendous case, right? You know, so you're going to have the divergence in this, but where it can help is that village mentality, and also getting rid of the stigma. The hardest thing, especially of our generation, of the Gen Xers getting older, we don't ask for help. We think we got it all, especially when you're dealing with a mom that's a type A hard charger, trying to hold it all together, wants a big family, wants to be able to be the labor and delivery nurse, wants to be the great wife, wants to be the great mother, and wants to have more kids. You know, that is the go, 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 go. And so getting rid of the stigma that it's okay to ask for help, and she was, it's not, it has nothing to do this with her, but other people. And just recognize that, hey, if the system's failing, we all got to come together. And here's the red flags we saw because of this case. And here's what we're going to do differently because of this case. You know, we're going to get you away from the kids. We're going to get you some better help. We're going to go to other people that can actually centralize the diagnoses, centralize your medications, centralize everything, and demand it. And here's what people also fall into in the world of mental health and just our healthcare system all overall. We relinquish control thinking these people are experts, but you are the customer. Never forget you're the customer. If you are not getting the service you want, you demand something different or go someplace else with your money and your health insurance money if you have it.
Yeah. Advocating for oneself is more important than ever. And in no way, I know people are like, well, she should have done this. She's a labor and delivery nurse.
No, she did everything.
She did everything. She did advocate for herself, and the system still failed. There's only so much advocating one can do. But honest to God, I mean, that is so true for anything. I've learned in the last 10, 20 years, I feel like, and you just need to do more and more and more of it, because relying on the system, quote unquote, to do its job is something no one should ever do. Now, it would be great if our systems did do it most of the time and we didn't have to double check everything, but the reality is it's broken. So many are broken.
I think Massachusetts will get better after this, but
maybe
anywhere else.
Maybe. Since 1692, they pretty much treat women's mental health the same way. I don't anticipate a massive shift anytime soon, but who knows? Another element of this, the fear of the med changes and lack of sleep. I have been with somebody who was going through postpartum. I know other people, but I mean, I've seen it firsthand. And the biggest fear, the biggest anxiety, the biggest piece in my world that I saw with someone who went through it that was so hard to watch was the fear of not getting enough sleep and the fear of changing a med, because the changing of the med can affect the sleep so much, and it ends up being a cycle that so many women go through when they're in postpartum. I know that what I went through was not unique. But it is, if you've never been there, to see it. But that cycle is so common in situations like this. And it is extremely debilitating. And I don't think it gets enough attention and understanding of that vicious cycle of adjusting those meds and not getting sleep and the effects of not getting the sleep and the effects of not getting the right meds, or the adjusting to the side effects of the meds that kick in right away until the actual benefits of the meds kick in 6 weeks later. There's so many things at play here that are beyond the control of the brain of the person taking them. And this prosecution is telling a jury that person who's consuming all of this, that they're 100% in control. And if you think all the shit that we're putting into their brain that changes it has anything to do with it, well, that's just witchery. And that's where I have to walk away from this case, because it's insane.
Yeah. And there's one more thing on it too, Tony, and that is, she was extremely healthy as well. She's a runner. She's fitness oriented. She had her little gym downstairs in a basement, and which makes her even more highly attuned to changes in her body. And my own firsthand experience and many other people's firsthand experience, when you have shit that starts going sideways in your brain, where you feel out of control, whether it's because you have insomnia you're feeling depressed or you have anxiety, not just a word or a fleeting emotion, but seriously, you all of a sudden feel like you're not in control of your brain in any way whatsoever, even as something as light as that, it is absolutely terrifying. Yeah. Because your brain is like doing things that you are not telling it not to do, and it's doing it anyway. And what a psychotic break is, it takes it beyond what anyone can even imagine if you've never been through it yourself. That's why it's so hard for everyone to fathom, because not being in control of what your brain is saying and thinking or your actions because of what it's telling you is terrifying, and we can't absorb it.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to work our way through this case. And if you want access every day to the trial coverage, we got it for you on our podcast channel, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, wherever you get podcasts. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and press subscribe.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack, craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.